Warren Buffett. I mean, the name just says it all when you think about investing success, right?
Absolutely. Legendary status.
But what if the real secrets to how he turned roughly $105,000 into something like $20 billion didn't come straight from him?
Yeah, that's the fascinating angle here. The insights come from people close to him, his former daughter-in-law, Mary Buffett, and a longtime family friend and analyst, David Clark.
Exactly. They kind of decoded his methods, calling it Buffettology. And, you know, for anyone listening who wants to understand that kind of success without getting totally bogged down in finance jargon, well, that's what we're diving into today.
And what makes it so interesting is that Buffett himself didn't, you know, actively participate in their book. So you get this unique, almost outsider looking in perspective.
Filtered through people who really saw it happen.
Right. Mary Buffett saw the family side, the discretion around his investment moves.
Yeah.
And David Clark, he brings that analyst brain, the financial background, to explain the numbers behind it. It's a really potent combination.
Mary's path into that world was, well, quite something. Before marrying Peter Buffett, Warren's son, she was already a businesswoman, right? Music publishing, import-export.
Mm-hmm. Successful in her own right.
Then suddenly she's in this, you know, iconic financial family, and she mentions this sort of code of silence around Warren's investing. Very private.
It wasn't like he was holding seminars at the dinner table.
No. It wasn't until after her divorce in 1993 that she felt she could actually share what she'd observed. And it wasn't just theory for her. She saw this fortune being built day by day.
And that's key. These weren't just like abstract ideas back then. It was a very private way of operating. Her own business sense probably gave her a really grounded view of what was going on, even though she couldn't, you know, broadcast it at the time.
And then to really get the full picture, she teamed up with David Clark.
Right. Based in Omaha, family friend, already known as a pretty sharp Buffettologist himself.
So he brought that financial historian piece, explaining the economic logic, the why behind the numbers that led to that incredible success. He gives it that analytical framework.
Clark's part is really crucial. He connects Mary's observations, the stories, the atmosphere with the actual financial results. He helps translate it all into principles you can actually grasp.
So if you're listening and you really want to get the core ideas behind smart long-term investing, maybe you manage some money. Maybe you're just curious about how legends like Buffett did it, this deep dive. It's for you.
Yeah, we're trying to cut through the noise, give you the essentials of Buffettology without, you know, making your head spin.
Think of us as guides, really, helping you get those aha moments.
Exactly. The goal isn't like become Warren Buffett tomorrow. It's more about getting that fundamental shift in perspective thinking like a business owner when you look at stocks.
That alone can help you make better financial choices or see the market less like a casino.
And more like a collection of actual businesses with real value. It's about building a solid framework for thinking about your financial future.
Okay, so let's get into the nuts and bolts. How does this Buffettology actually work? Mary tells this great story about Buffett family Christmases.
Oh yeah, this is classic.
Early on, Warren would literally hand out envelopes with like $10,000 cash to his kids, their spouses. Can you imagine?
Quite the stocking stuffer. But the interesting part is how it changed.
Right. It wasn't just about the money. It evolved into a teaching moment about ownership.
Mm-hmm. There was a deliberate shift there, not just generosity, but a lesson in how wealth is really built over time.
So later, instead of cash, it was $10,000 worth of stock in companies he'd recently bought into. Mary mentions names like Capital Cities, Freddie Mac, ServiceMaster.
And this wasn't random. It was designed to make them pay attention to the businesses. You know that quote from Walter Schloss? You never really know a company until you own part of it.
That's it. It forces you to care a bit more.
These weren't just symbols. They were like practical homework assignments in being an owner. Think about the annual reports, the performance.
And she said it worked. Suddenly, the Wall Street Journal is lying around the house. They're actually tracking these companies. And what struck her most was Warren's total lack of interest in the daily market swings.
Yeah, he wasn't checking the Dow every 5 minutes or listening to predictions.
No. His focus was laser sharp on the long-term health and prospects of the businesses he owned pieces of. It wasn't about timing the market. It was about understanding the enterprise.
And that really highlights a core difference. Wall Street gets obsessed with the short-term noise, right? But Buffett, even way back then, was all about the fundamentals. Thinking like he owned the whole company, not just a fleeting stock certificate. That's foundational.
Now, to really get the roots of this business perspective investing, you have to talk about Benjamin Graham.
The mentor. Professor, boss at Graham Newman, friend,
yeah.
Hugely influential.
And Graham's big teaching, the one Buffett always comes back to, was investments are most intelligent when they are most businesslike. Okay, so what does businesslike actually mean here?
It means you fundamentally change how you view a stock. It stops being just a ticker symbol, just a price bouncing around.
Right.
And it becomes what it actually is, a small piece of ownership in a real operating business. So you need to analyze its economics, revenues, costs, assets, debts, just like you would if you were thinking of buying the whole thing outright.
So Buffett's main goal, according to Mary and David, it's about buying these excellent businesses, but critically, at a price that makes good business sense.
Exactly. He's searching for the highest predictable annual rate of return, compounding over time with the least amount of risk possible.
That word predictable feels really important there. It's not about chasing moonshots.
Precisely. If you can reasonably predict the earnings power, you have a much better handle on future returns, and that automatically lowers your risk. He looks for understandable businesses, established track records, not hype or unproven tech.
They use that great analogy. Imagine buying a local business, like a corner store or maybe a small pharmacy.
Yeah, it's very relatable.
You wouldn't just focus on what someone might pay you for it next Tuesday, right? You'd dig into its profits, how consistent they are, potential growth. And then you'd look at the asking price compared to its yearly earnings to figure out your likely return.
That nails it. That's the long-term value mindset. You're thinking about years of income, building equity, short-term price swings, less relevant if the underlying business is solid. That's the big gap between Buffett's view and a lot of Wall Street thinking.
And Buffett really takes this ownership idea seriously when it comes to the company's profits, its earnings.
Mm-hmm.
He sees those earnings as his, proportional to his stake, whether they're paid out as dividends or reinvested back into the company.
Which was kind of different back then, right? A lot of people only counted earnings when the dividend check arrived.
Yeah. But Buffett understood that if a company can reinvest its own profit at a really high rate of return, maybe better than you could get yourself, and do it tax efficiently.
Because those retained earnings aren't taxed at the personal level until you sell.
Right. Then that actually builds more wealth for the shareholder in the long run. I mean, look at Berkshire Hathaway. Decades of insane growth, never paid a dividend. It's the ultimate proof.
It really is. That principle in action.
Okay, so how does he figure out if the price makes business sense? That brings us to intrinsic value.
Yeah, the cornerstone of value investing.
Mary and David explained it pretty simply.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the estimated annual compounding return you expect over the life of the investment. They give an example. Buy a share for $10, you reasonably project it'll be worth $50 in 10 years. That works out to about, what, 17.5% a year compounded?
Roughly, yeah. And it's that anticipated rate of return that he's constantly weighing against other potential investments, always looking for the best risk-adjusted return over the long haul.
But the key is how you get to that future value estimate.
Exactly. And for Buffett, it comes back to focusing on businesses whose future earnings he feels he can predict with a pretty high degree of certainty. Predictability equals lower risk, equals a more reliable estimate of that intrinsic value.
So, summing up these initial points from Mary and David, Buffett's approach rests on predictable earnings, which come from owning truly excellent businesses, often these consumer monopolies we'll talk more about.
Right. Businesses that generate high returns on the money shareholders have invested, strong overall profits, run by managers who think like owners.
And crucially, bought at the right price. He's aiming high, too, looking for 15% or better annual returns over the long term.
And that high standard really shows how disciplined and selective he is. He's not trying to hit singles all over the place. He wants home runs from businesses he understands inside and out. That predictable earnings piece is the bedrock.
Now, this whole philosophy didn't just spring out of nowhere, right? Mary and David talk about the key thinkers who shaped his approach.
Yeah, it's like his intellectual Mount Rushmore.
Obviously, Benjamin Graham, the business perspective, the focus on price versus value. But then you've got Philip Fisher.
Fisher pushed him towards appreciating truly excellent businesses, not just cheap ones. The idea that the best time to sell a great company is, well, maybe never.
That's a big shift. And Lawrence M. Bloomberg, less famous maybe, but he emphasized the power of the consumer monopoly, that idea of brands having real pricing power.
We'll definitely unpack that one. It's huge.
Then there's John Burr Williams, linking a company's worth to its future earnings. Lord John Maynard Keynes, surprisingly, influenced the idea of a concentrated portfolio.
Yeah, not over-diversifying.
Keir Smith on the value of retained earnings. And of course, maybe the biggest influence in his later thinking, Charlie Munger.
His longtime partner, Munger really reinforced that shift: buy wonderful businesses at a fair price rather than fair businesses at a wonderful price.
Quite a mix of ideas.
It is. And what's amazing is how Buffett could take all these different strands, some seemingly opposed, and weave them into his own incredibly effective strategy. He didn't just copy one person. He synthesized the best parts.
And a huge part of that strategy's power comes down to compounding.
The eighth wonder of the world, right?
Mary and David really hammer this home. We all kind of know the term, but their examples make it so vivid. Forget doubling your money every year. That's fantasy. But even seemingly small percentage gains reinvested year after year.
The growth becomes exponential over time.
Right. They show $100,000 growing tax-free for 30 years. At 5% a year, it's over $430,000. Okay, yeah. Nice. But bump that return to 10%. It's over $1.7 million.
Big jump.
At 15%, it's $6.6 million. And at 20% annual return, over $23 million. From the same starting point, those percentage points matter hugely over decades.
It's mind-boggling when you see it laid out like that. And Buffett's own record at Berkshire, averaging nearly 24% a year for over 30 years, that's the power of compounding made real. It's why finding businesses that can consistently generate those strong returns is paramount.
And they make a really important distinction between that kind of stock compounding and, say, getting fixed interest from a bond.
Yeah, that's often overlooked.
With a bond, you get your interest, sure, but then you pay income tax on it every year, which drags down your real return.
Mm-hmm.
But with a stock, viewed as Buffett does, like an equity bond,
mm-hmm.
if the company retains and reinvests its earnings wisely, your capital grows without that annual tax hit.
At least not at the personal level, until you sell, which ideally for Buffett might be never. That tax deferral is a massive accelerant to compounding over the long term.
Huge advantage.
Yeah.
And as they stress, the price you initially pay for that stock is absolutely critical to your final compounding rate.
Oh, definitely. Buy a great company, but pay too much. Your long-term return gets seriously dampened. They used Philip Morris as an example. Buying at $6 versus $10 a share back in 87 made a huge difference in the outcome years later. Value matters. Price matters.
And I love the anecdote about Buffett driving older cars.
Ha! Huh. Yeah, it's famous. But it's not just about being frugal, is it?
No. It's about understanding opportunity cost. That, say, $20,000 you don't spend on a fancy new car that will just depreciate. If you invest it and let it compound, over decades it could become hundreds of thousands, maybe more.
It really puts everyday spending choices into a different light, doesn't it? It's that long-term, value-focused thinking applied everywhere. Always thinking about what that dollar could become if invested well.
Okay, so we know he wants excellent businesses. And a key feature of these, according to Mary and David, is this consumer monopoly. Now, this isn't like, you know, the electric company being the only game in town.
No, it's not a legal monopoly. It's more about market power derived from the consumer.
So how do they define it? What makes a consumer monopoly?
It's a business selling something where the brand is so strong or consumer habit is so ingrained that price isn't the main driver for the buyer.
People feel they need it or strongly prefer it, maybe willing to pay a bit more.
Exactly. Think about brands you just automatically reach for. That loyalty, that recognition, creates a huge moat, a barrier that makes it really tough for competitors to break in.
And they draw a really sharp contrast between these and what they call commodity-type businesses.
Right. Polar opposites, really.
These are businesses selling stuff that's basically undifferentiated. Price is everything. Think basic textiles, raw materials like corn or steel, oil, lumber.
In those industries, it's brutal competition. The lowest cost producer usually wins. Margins are thin. There's this constant treadmill of having to reinvest heavily in better equipment just to stay competitive.
Which really limits the profits left over for investors, right?
Right. Absolutely. In commodity businesses, brand loyalty is almost non-existent. If someone offers the same basic thing cheaper, customers will switch in a heartbeat. Success often boils down to management being incredibly efficient, squeezing every penny out of their physical assets, the factories, the machines.
They use Burlington Industries, the textile maker, as a stark example.
Yeah, a classic case study.
Billions spent over decades on modernization, efficiency. But the stock price barely moved long term. The tough economics of the industry itself, intense competition, overcapacity, zero pricing power, just couldn't be overcome, even with good management.
It proves Buffett's point, doesn't it? When management with an excellent reputation meets business with a poor fundamental reputation, it is usually the business's reputation that remains intact.
Ouch. But true, the business economics often matter more than the managers.
While great management helps, it's fighting an uphill battle in a fundamentally weak industry.
So how do we spot these amazing consumer monopolies? They use the toll bridge analogy.
Which is brilliant, I think.
Yeah.
So simple and clear.
Imagine the only bridge into town, or the only newspaper everyone reads. They have pricing power, right? Because customers or advertisers don't have many other options.
That ability to raise prices without losing much business translates directly into higher, more reliable profits. That's the core idea of the consumer monopoly controlling that essential bridge.
And Buffett apparently has this conceptual test. If he had billions of dollars and could hire the best managers in the world, could he successfully build a business to compete head-to-head with this company?
And if the answer is a resounding no way, that's a strong sign it's got a powerful consumer monopoly.
They give some great examples we all know. The Wall Street Journal for essential financial news, Wrigley's gum, just ubiquitous.
Hershey's chocolate, Coca-Cola, that story about finding Coke and only Coke at some tiny stand in rural Indonesia, that says it all about global reach and ingrained demand.
Mary asks that killer question. Can you name another brand that basically every kind of store, gas stations, supermarkets, cinemas just has to carry? It really makes you think about brand power.
That near necessity, that ubiquity, that's the mark of a true consumer monopoly. And interestingly, these companies often don't need endless investment in new factories. Their value is in the intangible stuff, the brand, the formula, the distribution network.
So they tend to be cash machines, often with little debt, like Wrigley or U.S. Tobacco back in the day.
Right. And often they're in pretty low-tech industries, which means their factories can stay useful for longer, unlike, say, a semiconductor plant that needs constant, expensive upgrades. They even mentioned GE, built on dominating various sectors early on.
Okay, so knowing what these look like, Mary Buffett lays out 9 key questions, supposedly straight from Warren's playbook, to help identify them. Let's touch on the big ones. First, obviously, does it have an identifiable consumer monopoly? A brand or service people depend on.
And a great product is just the start, right? The brand needs that staying power.
Second, are the earnings strong and trending up? Consistent growth in earnings per share is vital.
You want to see that track record. Question 3, is it conservatively financed? A real consumer monopoly should be throwing off cash, not drowning in debt.
Unless maybe it's borrowing smartly to buy another consumer monopoly, but debt to buy a commodity business. Big red flag.
Yeah, that usually ends badly. Dilutes the good business. Question 4 is about profitability. Does it consistently earn a high rate of return on shareholders' equity, or ROE?
This is just looking for consistency above the average, maybe 15% or higher. And they explain ROE simply like the return on your stake if you owned a rental house. The key is consistency.
Year in, year out. Not just one good year. Question 5 gets into reinvestment. Does the business get to keep a lot of its earnings?
Right. Referencing Edgar Lawrence Smith, retained earnings, if reinvested well, boost net worth and should boost the stock price. But not all companies can reinvest profitably. Many just need the cash for upkeep.
Buffett wants those special ones that can reinvest at high rates, fueling that compounding magic for shareholders.
Which leads straight to question 6. How much does it have to spend just to stay in business, just on maintenance?
Yeah, the ideal is high earnings, low upkeep. They contrast a capital hog like old AT&T with a publisher like Thomson, much lower capital needs, more cash left over.
Question 7 is about capital allocation. Can the company reinvest retained earnings smartly in new opportunities, expansion, or buying back its own stock? And crucially, is management any good at this?
Because if there aren't great places to reinvest or management stinks at it, Buffett would rather see that cash come back as dividends or buybacks.
Buybacks are good too, right? They increase earnings per share.
If done at the right price, yes. Smart capital allocation by management is critical.
Question 8. Can it raise prices with inflation without killing demand? That's a hallmark of pricing power.
Big advantage over commodity businesses like airlines, stuck with rising costs but unable to easily raise fares due to competition.
And the last one, number 9, ties it all together. Will the value added by those retained earnings eventually show up in the stock price?
Buffett's bet is yes. Over time, the market tends to recognize companies that consistently grow their underlying economic value through smart reinvestment. It's not about speculation, it's about the business getting more valuable. Berkshire itself is the ultimate proof.
Wow, those 9 questions really give you a solid checklist, don't they? A framework for thinking like Buffett.
Absolutely. It forces you to look deeply at the business quality, the management, the long-term economics.
Okay, so If someone listening wants to actually find these toll bridge businesses, where do they start looking? Mary and David give some practical categories.
Yeah, they break it down nicely.
First category, those brands that wear out or get used up quickly, the ones retailers have to stock. They say, just mentally walk the aisles of a 7-Eleven or a pharmacy.
Mm-hmm. Coca-Cola, Marlboro, Skoll, Hershey's, Wrigley's, Crest, Advil, Gillette, the list goes on. These guys often have fantastic returns because stores need them on the shelf.
The advertising creates the demand, forces the store to stock it, and the manufacturer profits. Simple, but powerful. Even chains like McDonald's, branding generic food.
They built their own toll bridge around burgers and fries. Second category, communication businesses. The ones providing repetitive services that manufacturers need for advertising.
Like TV networks, though maybe less powerful now with more channels. Dominant local newspapers, big ad agencies serving global brands. They're the conduits.
Exactly. Businesses benefiting from the constant need to advertise. Still valuable, even as media changes.
And the third category, businesses providing repetitive consumer services that people and other businesses consistently need.
Things like ServiceMaster for cleaning and pest control, Rollins, Orkin, H&R Block for taxes, credit card companies like Amex or Discover.
These often have low capital needs, no product obsolescence. People always need their taxes done, their pests dealt with, right?
Pretty much. They tap into essential recurring needs, often have sticky customer bases, stable revenues, very attractive models.
So for the listener wanting to apply this, Mary and David have some surprisingly down-to-earth advice.
Yeah, it's not about complex algorithms.
Start just by noticing those must-carry brands in your local stores. That's your first clue to potential consumer jackpots. Then, crucially, figure out what the company actually makes and how it's used. Operate in your circle of competence, as Buffett said.
Know what you're buying. Then comes the research, and it's kind of refreshingly old school. Look at the package, find the manufacturer, call them, ask for the annual report.
Which is free if they're public. If not, move on. But if you get that report, the digging starts. Head to the library.
Remember libraries. Use the Guide to Business periodicals. Find articles from Fortune, Forbes, Business Week, going back years. Get the history, the context, competitor quotes.
Yeah, that historical perspective is gold. See how they weathered past storms, what experts were saying then versus now.
Then look for other library resources like Value Line Investment Survey or Moody's Guides. They compile years of financial data, essential for tracking things like ROE and earnings growth over time. Subscribing might even be worth it if you're serious.
Once you have the history and the numbers, then you start analyzing. Run the numbers yourself, ROE, earnings growth. Try to estimate that intrinsic value we talked about. But always remember.
Predictable earnings are key. If you can't reasonably forecast the future, the calculations are just guesswork.
And they love Philip Fisher's scuttlebutt approach.
Yeah, getting out there and talking to people, competitors, customers, even the managers of stores selling the product. Get the real world view.
The story of young Warren literally driving down to Geico headquarters because he saw Ben Graham was chairman. That's scuttlebutt in action. Pure determination.
It is. They even suggest calling institutions pension funds, mutual funds that own the stock. Analysts might share general insights. It's about piecing together the puzzle from many angles.
It's definitely an active approach, not just looking at screens.
No, it requires real effort, real digging, due diligence.
Let's head shift to some of the behind-the-scenes stuff Mary and David reveal about Buffett's style. His tendency to buy when things look worst.
Yeah, the ultimate contrarian sometimes. Think Wells Fargo in the early 90s, Amex after the salad oil scandal in the 60s, J.I. Co. when it nearly went bust in the 70s.
He's buying when everyone else is selling. Why?
It goes back to Graham again. The market often overreacts wildly to bad news in the short term. That panic pushes prices down way below the real long-term value, creating opportunities for the patient investor.
Like the ski resort having one bad snow year, the business itself isn't permanently damaged.
Exactly. They mentioned Capital City's stock dropping just because earnings were projected flat during a recession. The market freaked out, but the underlying media business was still solid. It bounced back big time later.
Yeah.
Buffett loves those overreactions.
And it's not just market panic. He also jumps on specific company mistakes if they seem fixable.
Right. J.I. Co.'s bad underwriting strategy, Amex's salad oil fiasco. In both cases, the core franchise, the consumer monopoly, was still strong underneath. He saw the problems were temporary and solvable with good management.
The Coke lawsuit analogy fits here too, right? A big one-time hit might scare the market, but it doesn't kill the value of that global brand.
Precisely. The market eventually looks past the temporary issue, and the price reflects the underlying strength again. It takes discipline to see that when everyone else is focused on the bad news.
And interestingly, his view on inflation evolved.
Yeah, that's fascinating. Initially, he saw it as bad for most businesses.
But later, he realized that for those strong consumer monopolies with low capital needs, inflation could actually be a tailwind. See's Candy is the classic example.
Right. As general prices doubled, See's could double its candy prices, doubling earnings. But because it didn't need massive new factories like, say, a steel company, its costs didn't balloon nearly as much. The steel company's earnings might double, but so does the cost of replacing its furnaces.
So inflation hurts capital-intensive businesses more. Another win for the low-asset consumer monopoly.
It's a really crucial insight about pricing power and asset intensity.
And on diversification. Buffett's famous quote, it's protection against ignorance.
Huh. Because he does such deep homework on a few companies, he feels comfortable being concentrated. That idea came partly from Keynes, actually. Each investment is a major commitment.
It requires incredible confidence and thoroughness.
Which brings us to patience, maybe his greatest superpower.
He compares it to baseball. You don't have to swing at every pitch. You wait for the perfect one, right in your sweet spot.
Exactly. He's perfectly happy sitting on cash, sometimes for years, until he sees a great business, great management at a fantastic price. Most investors can't stand an activity like that. They feel they have to do something.
That impatience is deadly.
It is. He even shut down his original investment partnership in the early 70s because he just didn't see enough good opportunities that fit his criteria.
Unbelievable discipline.
But meant he was ready with cash when the market eventually tanked, offering up bargains again. Patience pays.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive into Buffettology, drawing from Mary Buffett and David Clark's insights, maybe the final thought is this. Real investment success, the kind that lasts. It's probably not about frantic activity or chasing fads.
Mm-hmm. It's more about that patient business owner mindset.
Yeah. Waiting for that truly great opportunity, that perfect pitch, and then having the conviction to act decisively. Maybe start noticing those toll bridge businesses in your own life. Could understanding their value be a key for you?
It's a powerful shift, focusing on the underlying business value, not just the flickering stock price. That's always going to be the more intelligent path in the long run.
A great place to leave it. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive. We really hope it's given you some valuable, maybe even actionable insights into a truly powerful investment philosophy.